ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. And for the month of February, Lauren Humphreys-Brooks joins me to talk about Ida Lupino. This week, we'll be talking about her work as an actress, looking at the 1946 costume drama, Devotion.
Promise me love for love, and I'm yours till the end of time. Love is a wondrous adventure, something that no one should miss. If you want me, darling, take me. All that I ask is this.
Born in the idyllic-sounding Hemi Hill in London, Ida Lupino had entertainment in her blood. Her mother was an actress and her father was a music hall entertainer who was part of the famed Lupino family that had its roots all the way back to the Renaissance. Ida got into the family business early, alongside her sister Rita, who you can actually see in the credits to several of Ida Lupino's features. At the age of 7, Ida wrote her first play, something she desperately wanted to pursue, though her father wasn't keen on it. Considering she was writing a play at 7, I'm surprised he didn't encourage her as a prodigy. He sent her to study at the acclaimed Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, where she took up acting. After leaving school, Ida started working with various British studios. She was dubbed the English Jean Harlow, complete with platinum blonde do, and her first starring role was at the tender age of 14 in the film called Her First Affair. She signed a 5-year contract with Paramount in 1933 and made her American debut in 1934's Search for Beauty. Search for Beauty is a very bizarre film involving Buster Crabbe and a wellness clinic and con artistry, and Ida is just there. It was evident that the studio didn't know what to do with her and was hoping to make her the next Betty Davis. And Ida herself was aware of this and would refuse to take roles that she felt were Betty Davis hand-me-downs. She was a smart woman even then.
I heard the note. I saw the doors. The doors made me do it. Yes. The doors made me do it. The doors made me do it. The doors made me do it!
In 1940, after a decade of middling Una Merkel, Jean Harlow-esque roles, Ida Lupino snagged the juicy role of Lana Carlson in the Raoul Walsh noir They Drive by Night, which is the clip that just started the section. She'd follow this up with stronger noir roles in the likes of High Sierra with Humphrey Bogart, Out of the Fog with John Garfield, and Beware My Lovely with Robert Ryan. She was a great actress to star opposite strong leading men, well, mostly because she acted as their equal. The advent of World War II saw Lupino's role change, though. She was softened to satisfy those on the home front. And Devotion was one of several prestige pictures that was filmed before the war intensified, and it was hoped that it would secure Ida Lupino some much-needed prestige and possibly some awards. As we'll discuss later, that didn't necessarily happen.
Sometimes I come here in the silence of the night to watch that house that stands alone on the windswept heights. And then some strange attraction carries me across the lonely, desolate moors to its forbidding walls. Nearer and nearer its dark secrets. Closer and closer to the most fascinating man I've ever known.
Filmed between 1942 and 1943, Devotion attempted to harken back to other literary adaptations, like 1939's Wuthering Heights, 1940's Rebecca, and Jane Eyre. Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre are incredibly appropriate, considering that this is a loose biopic in the lives of the Bronte sisters, two of them more specifically. Devotion had the distinction of putting Lupino as Emily Bronte alongside that of Olivia de Havilland as Charlotte Bronte. The two actresses were well known for being a headache to their studios, each of them suspended multiple times for refusing assignments. During the filming of Devotion, de Havilland ended up suing Warner Brothers. Though she'd later win that lawsuit in a momentous legal challenge known as the de Havilland decision, it led to the belief that Devotion had been held up by the litigation. In actuality, Devotion was one of many features filmed during the early 40s and released towards the end of the decade after the war had ended, since it was deemed inappropriate to have such a lavish costume drama in theaters during a time of rationing. Regardless, Devotion was released 3 years after being filmed in 1946, and it's doubtful that a release in 1943 would have helped. Bosley Crowther, the famed critic, found the film reductive, and that it condensed the lives of the Bronte sisters into a, quote, couple of little women with a gift. This had to disappoint Warners, as they'd put a large amount of money into Devotion, hiring legendary composer Eric Wolfgang Korngold to craft the score, and getting a production design that drew comparisons to the aforementioned Wuthering Heights. For her part, Ida Lupino continued to resent the role she was given throughout 1940, returning to noir as often as possible before taking a turn directing in the 1950s. When we return, Lauren Humphreys-Brooks joins me to look more at the questionable 1946 costume drama, Devotion.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I've got a little story you ought to know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road.
I've made a horrible mistake picking the movie that I picked this week. Not the intro you usually get from me, everybody. Before I introduce everything, let's preface a little bit here. I am writing a piece for TCM Backlot about Ida Lupino for her centenary, and I am watching every Ida Lupino movie that I can find. Well, when I planned this episode, I said, okay, well, I hadn't watched all these movies yet, so I'll just pick something that sounds like it's good and that I can talk about and might encapsulate her career. So I picked 1946's Devotion, mostly because it's about the Brontes, and I love the Brontes, so I figured, well, worst case scenario, I'll have a lot to talk about. Oh, do I? Because this movie is interesting. So when you ask, which someone will inevitably ask, why out of all the Ida Lupino movies that I could have picked, which my guest and I will talk about some other ones that I think are better than the one we're talking about today, that's why. Just hadn't gotten to them yet. Let's dive right in. I am joined this month by the lovely and amazing Lauren Humphreys-Brooks, you might recall from our Christmas in Connecticut episode. Lauren, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
You are a trooper for doing this episode with me. Actually, you were the one who gave me my first indication that we might have an episode that'll be interesting. I think the last episode that we did for a movie that you could tell me and the guest did not like was Unsinkable Molly Brown, which we felt very bad about because it was my Debbie Reynolds tribute. We picked a movie that encapsulated a key point in her career, but it was not a movie that we particularly enjoyed. Lauren, I'll give you a chance to promote at the end because you've already been on the show recently. So let's just dive right into this. Devotion is the story of the Bronte family, the famous authors Emily, Anne, and Charlotte, played in this film. Really, you only need to know Emily and Charlotte, Ida Lupino and Olivia de Havilland, respectively. Anne is there for a bit, and she just kind of disappears. But the movie also involves their brother, the drunken Branwell. Is it Branwell or Branwell? Because I felt like I was saying his name wrong.
It's Branwell. B-R-A-N.
Okay, which says a lot, because his name has Bran in the title. Their brother Branwell, played by Arthur Kennedy. In case you really want to know, Anne Bronte is played by Nancy Coleman. And of course, there is a love triangle between Charlotte and Emily, and the Reverend Arthur Nichols, essentially the curate, because there's always a curate in the Bronte's novels, played by Paul Henri. That's really all you need to know about this movie. In case you're really curious, this movie is directed by Curtis Bernhardt, who made another movie that I really love, that much like this movie was filmed at one point and then released several years later. He did My Reputation, which I've talked about before, was one of my favorite Barbara Stanwyck movies. That actually came out the year before this. They were both filmed about the same time, but because of the war, they came out a couple years later. My Reputation is very soapy. It's very melodramatic. It's a Douglas Sirk movie without the Douglas Sirkiness. Obviously, I had never seen this before. Lauren, what's your background with Ida Lupino and her films, and this film in particular, before you saw it?
I've seen quite a few Ida Lupino films, particularly some of the more famous ones, things like High Sierra, They Drive by Night. So I'm much more in her hard-boiled section. I've also seen quite a number of her later films and most of the films that she did as a director, at least the ones that are available. I love Ida Lupino. Like, she's actually grown on me, particularly after I began watching the films that she directed and that she produced. So she's kind of an odd actress because she's British, which I did not know, because she seems so incredibly American in so many ways. That's just the impression that I've always gotten from her. This film I had never even heard of until you suggested it. And I was like, oh, the Brontes. Okay, yeah, Ida Lupino. And then I was like, oh, Olivia de Havilland. Wow, this is going to be great. I have a feeling that I didn't dislike it as much as you did, but I was not a fan. I did have to watch it in two sections just because I got bored about halfway through.
Yeah, this took me all day to watch because I would just stop and do something else and then I would come back and I'd be like, why is this movie not ending?
It's always a very bad sign if I'm sitting watching a movie in any capacity and I begin just reaching for my phone. And I'm like, no, why am I doing this? I should be focused on the phone. I'm like, but what's happening on Twitter? That's not a good sign.
No, it's not. I've been watching nothing but Ida Lupino movies. I've been watching two Ida Lupino movies a day for the last 2 weeks. And I started at the beginning. So I'm starting from a completely different area where I knew Ida Lupino more as a director, particularly of television. So I'm a big fan of like her Twilight Zone episodes that she did. And I'd seen her two big films that she directed, Outrage and The Bigamist, which we're going to talk about Outrage next time. I had really never noticed her as an actress. I knew I had seen movies where she was an actress, but I'd never really taken the time to notice her. So starting at the beginning of her career, which I would agree with you, I did not know she was British, and watching a lot of her British output, it's really interesting. She is an actress that I think has gone through more career inventions than anybody that I know from the studio era. They really did not seem to know what to do with her. In Britain, she started out as like a Daffy Dame. She was usually the Dizzy heiress or the bad girl who dated married men and had aspirations of grandeur.
And the bad girl persona definitely goes through to her Hollywood work, but not the Dizzy Dame thing. She's not that way.
She starts out as an English Jean Harlow, complete with platinum blonde hair. It's very bizarre. And it took a long time as I was going through the 30s. The movies all just started to seem the same. Early 30s screwball pre-code comedies. Nothing really amazing unless you watch something like I Lived With You, which is not a movie you watch for her. You watch it for Ivor Novello, and it's really funny. As I've gotten into her 40s work, you really see that twist to film noir, and she seems a lot more comfortable in film noir than she does in costume dramas. So I was fortunate. I got to see They Drive by Night, which I thought she was so good in. I recently watched Out of the Fog. I watched that before I watched this, and that was so amazing, and I was so disappointed that I had to follow it up with this. Even some of her British American outputs, like I just watched Ladies in Retirement, which is good. If Arsenic and Old Lace was serious, with her and Elsa Lanchester, actually I'd done that because it's a movie about sisters that is infinitely better.
Yeah, I'm gonna seek that one out, actually.
Yes, YouTube. It's really good. A lot of her stuff's on YouTube, actually. I think we can both see the appeal of this movie.
Yeah.
It's a costume drama. It's got her and Olivia de Havilland in it. It's directed by Curtis Bernhardt, who had made a lot of movies. Paul Henri Reed's in this, coming off of Casablanca. Sydney Greenstreet, Dame Mae Whitty. I mean, you have a lot of big players. Where do you think this movie goes wrong?
Everywhere. I just mentioned Sydney Greenstreet and Dame Mae Whitty. They are in maybe like 5 minutes of the film. And Greenstreet lights up the screen. Like, he comes on, you're just like, yay, Sydney Greenstreet is here, and he's hilarious. Dame Mae Whitty is there for like two scenes, maybe, and doesn't really do much of anything. So again, it feels like kind of a waste. Part of it is that the film can't quite decide what it wants to focus on. Is it going to focus on Emily? Is it going to focus on Charlotte? Is it going to focus on the relationship among the siblings? Is it going to focus on this weird sort of love triangle that gets going? Or is it going to focus on these siblings' relationship, particularly in terms of the three sisters and their brother, which gets all kinds of weird the longer the film goes on? There's a lot of scene shifting. We wind up in Brussels for a while, and then we get back in Yorkshire. It's very confusing. And it just doesn't make a great deal of use of the definite talents that are sitting right there.
None of us expected this to be an accurate look at the Brontes at all.
No. These films never are.
Yeah, this highly fictionalized look at the Brontes. You bring up pretty much one of my first talking points, which is, whose film is this really? Because I'd say it's everybody's and nobody's. The introduction of Branwell, and everybody's very concerned about sending Branwell to England. And Ida Lupino, as Emily, gets this star-making entrance in the movie. You know, the camera changes and looks up at her, and she's got this big presence. Until Olivia de Havilland takes center stage, and the entire second half of the movie is about her. She ends the movie! The key problem with Devotion is, which Bronte sister do we really want to focus on? Who has the more interesting story? Poor Anne. Nobody really cares about her in this movie.
Poor Anne, who's actually a great novelist and a very interesting figure, and gets totally treated like the dumb little sister.
She's the pretty one.
She wrote two books, two very fascinating and challenging books.
We gotta have the pretty one. We gotta have that one.
The film starts saying, oh, there were four siblings and two of them had genius. And the entire time I'm sitting there going like, which are the two? Which are the two that they're coming down on? Are they going to be like Emily and Branwell? Is it going to be Charlotte and Emily? Who has the genius in this family? Because we've obviously decided that at least two of them don't.
I was offended by how we keep trying to make Branwell this thing. And I mean, Branwell Bronte in the Bronte life history is a very complex figure, but the movie almost wants this to be about him. His sisters are really the entryway into looking at his life. You have this bickering between Emily and Charlotte that is all about men. It starts with their brother, and then it proceeds into being about Nichols, the Paul-Henri character. So when the movie starts, Anne and Charlotte wanting to send Branwell to England. Well, I would say it even starts before that with Branwell telling Emily, take my things that I've left out back to the house. And Emily says, you got two legs. Go take it back yourself. Yeah. And Anne and Charlotte are just like, oh, scandalous. You must cart his stuff on your back if he asks. And Emily says, he'll go to England, he'll get disillusioned. And they're like, Emily, you're insane. That'll never happen. And then when it does happen, Emily's still in the wrong. This poor woman can't get anything right where this guy is concerned. And that's really my problem. Branwell is this drunken figure, and we don't really even make the attempt to make him is he tragic? Is he a tragic drunk? They keep talking about how much of a genius he could be. That's like telling me I could speak Italian one day if I learned or bothered to care, but I don't. He doesn't have any interest in bettering himself, so why keep telling him that he's amazing?
There's an impression that the film wants this to be about genius thwarted at some level. His problems and the fact that he's spoiled, he's the only boy in a family full of girls. He has all this potential, but because he's drunken, because he's spoiled, because his fantasies are much grander than the reality of life. Like, there's this whole thing about if he goes to London, he's going to be disappointed. Which is exactly what happens. He goes to London and it's not the thing that he wants it to be. It's not the thing that he expects it to be. And that could have been an interesting dynamic where you've got three girls, all of whom are much more talented and capable than their brother and are much more able to apply their talents to their work, giving up so much in favor of the boy That could have been an interesting dynamic, but the film doesn't carry that through.
No, it really doesn't. And I had to get really mad. There's a scene where Emily is reading Branwell a section of Wuthering Heights. And Wuthering Heights is one of my favorite novels of all time. She's reading this beautiful passage, one of my favorite passages in the book. And Branwell's like, oh, that's okay. She's like, but Branwell, you could write an even better book. Emily! How dare you? There's not a better book, and he's sure as hell not going to write it. But there's a lot of them subsuming their own talent.
Which, again, has the potential for having a really interesting dynamic. Almost a very feminist bent. But because the film doesn't follow through on it, it just becomes annoying. You're just sitting there going, like, why are we so concerned about this obviously useless man whose sisters are supporting him constantly and defending him constantly?
And there's no real discussion for his hatred of them. Is he just a misogynist? Is it just that he's the only boy? And it goes back to what you were saying. He acts very rude towards them. I don't recall any scene of actual, like, compassion for his sisters from him. I see compassion between the sisters to each other, but he just seems to go straight to hate town. There's no real discussion of that.
The impression that I got was it was supposed to be jealousy. Basically, he understands that at least in the way that the film frames it, at least two of his sisters are smarter than he is and probably more talented than he is and certainly more able to apply their talents. And that's something that drives him crazy. And he wants to blame everybody for his problems except for himself. And, you know, and he's the one that's drinking constantly. He's the one that won't finish a project, that won't finish a painting, that won't try to do anything for himself. His sisters have to do it all. I found him a little more sympathetic. There's a good scene where it's just after he came back from London, and he just begins railing, I think, at Emily. Basically, how dare you send me to London? It was actually terrible, and it's all your fault. And then he just sort of breaks down and apologizes and says, this is all my fault, and walks away. Again, it's that sense that he's this tortured figure, but because the film then shifts focus completely, we never get that whole aspect of the narrative being followed through on and actually developing this very bizarre and complex relationship, particularly between Charlotte Branwell and Emily.
This emphasis on Branwell in the first half of the movie, more so I think than in the second half, really leads to something you and I both noticed, which is he and Emily act like they're lovers. This is not an isolated incident in cinema of the studio era. I've talked about how much I love Sunday in New York, but the whole joke of that movie's opening is that you assume Cliff Robertson and Jane Fonda are together and they're brother and sister. This movie has a similar bent where they're acting like spouses.
Yeah.
And it's really bizarre and awkward and uncomfortable.
There's a great line, and I think it's Thackeray, and it's nearing the end of the film. It's after both Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights have been published. He says, well, you're both in love with the same man. And of course, the implication is that it's the Nichols character, that's the Paul Heinrich character. But if you know those two books and you look at the way that Branwell is portrayed, just like he's the Byronic lover. He's Heathcliff and Rochester, not Paul Heinrich, who is like this sort of dull clergyman. And I never completely understand why these two women have that much interest in him, except he's the only other man.
Yeah, that's not blood related.
Brother. But hearing that, I was just like, yeah, they're both in love with their brother. They wrote books in which the heroes are their brother. That is what is being shown here. And then, spoiler alert, nearing the end of a section of the film when Branwell is dying, and he runs out into the rain because that's what gothic heroes do, and Emily chases after him. She's like cradling him as he's dying on the street, and she's holding him, and the dialogue, the way that they're photographed together, the way that it's blocked, there's one point where they almost kiss. And I'm sitting there watching this film going, you're in love with your brother. This whole story is about you being in love with Branwell. What is going on here? And it's a very weird structure of the film because the romantic hero is not really treated as the romantic hero. It's the brother of these two women.
And it happens right after she reads this section. I think it happens right after she reads the section of Wuthering Heights. So when he goes out, it's Heathcliff going out into the heath and Kathy going after. He's Mr. Rochester, he's Heathcliff. If anything, Nichols and Bronte fell in love with a curate for a brief amount of time. But I want to say it's Agnes Gray that the character is based on, the man that she loved who was the curate. So I thought, okay, maybe the Paul Henreid character is going to be inspiration for all three of these women, and he's really not, at least not for Anne. Paul Henreid doesn't conjure any Rochester-y, Heathcliff-y emotions at all. It's totally Branwell.
If you've read Wuthering Heights, obviously part of the tension in the Heathcliff-Kathy relationship is that there's a big question mark about Heathcliff's parentage, that he could be actually Kathy's half-brother. The film could have gone that direction even a little bit more, and they're not going to in the mid-40s. But it has this very interesting undercurrent. That was actually one of the sections of the film, and I was like, this is getting really weird and really kind of interesting, because that's what's happening. If you have any knowledge of Wuthering Heights, then you know that there's this tension there. We're basically having the corollary relationship between Emily and Branwell. It's quite odd.
It's the only relationship that I think is actually worth following, because Paul Henreid was a big deal. This was after Paul Henreid had made a big splash with Casablanca and now Voyager. So I can see why you would put him in this movie. The problem is that he offers nothing to these women. He's rude in a way that feels like he has to dominate or control, which part of his animosity with Charlotte is that she doesn't put up with his masculinity. A, he has no chemistry, I think, with any of them. And B, it's hard not to feel that he's a villain, because he meets Emily first and she thinks he's a drunken friend of Branwell's, but then when she realizes who he is, they have this friendship. That's all well and good, but then when Charlotte shows up, they actually do a thing of changing the music to make it show that this is where his heart truly lies. The whole movie is just spent with him chasing Charlotte, and no one's really telling anybody what's going on. So when poor Emily finds out that Nichols doesn't really care for her, she takes it out on her sister because her sister didn't tell her.
I've always been underwhelmed by Paul Henreid. Casablanca, I'm just like, why? Why would you leave Humphrey Bogart for this man? I don't get it. Yeah, sure, whatever. He's a hero of the resistance. Fine, whatever. He could go off and be in the resistance. Come on, Ingrid Bergman, like, seriously. The problem is that you're almost supposed to feel that in Casablanca. In pretty much every other film I've seen Paul Henreid in, I have the same feeling. Just like, why? I don't care. Why? Why are these women have any interest in this human being? I don't get it. So I'm already biased against Henreid. There's not chemistry between them. There's this whole tension of Charlotte not knowing that he's in love with her, which I never buy, because there's that very weird scene where he should either hit her or kiss her, and it's very disturbing. And then that happens, and she's like, okay, that happened, but then it seems like she completely forgets about it or ignores it. And then by the end of it, she's like, oh yeah, this guy's in love with me, and this is a problem because this is going to cause issues with my sister. The feelings about Charlotte and what Charlotte knows and doesn't know are very complicated. I don't know why any of these women would particularly give him a second glance, except for the fact that he appears to be the only other male in the entire town that is, you know, roughly of their class. It's basically him or Branwell.
He's the right guy. In movies, you always have the wrong guy and the right guy.
Yeah.
Paul Henreid is the nice, non-threatening, religious-bent man, in contrast to Branwell, who, let's say again, is their brother.
Well, if those are the choices, then obviously you go for the guy who isn't your brother.
It's either that or their dad.
Yes.
Or Sydney Greenstreet.
I would actually go for Sydney Greenstreet before Paul Henreid. He's at least funny, and he's rich, so, you know.
That's true. One of the things I usually dislike about biopics, and I disliked it here, I don't like when it's obvious that the intent that you're going for with your script is that the characters lived a life that was like their movies or their books. You see that a lot with, especially, like, when celebrity biopics first started to take a turn. And you'd see a lot of movies where something like Man of a Thousand Faces, where the characters were the person. There's no separation of persona. And so with the Brontes, you literally get a scene where Emily Bronte takes Nichols to this house and he says, "What's the name of that place? I call it Wuthering Heights." Or the fact that Charlotte is the meek and mild one, much like Jane Eyre. I really was like, okay, somebody read their best known books, except for Anne, because nobody really cares about her. And you're just writing that obviously Emily is not Emily Bronte, she's Kathy. Charlotte is not Charlotte Bronte, she's Jane. I didn't really care for that because I felt that, well, then why am I not watching, and we're going to talk about this, the wealth of Bronte adaptations that are out there.
I don't quite buy that Charlotte is like Jane Eyre, though. I think she wants to be like Jane Eyre to a certain sense, but she is very strong-willed. I mean, her whole speech to Nichols about Emily is like, "I have plans for my sister. And you're not going to interfere with them." She's got this drive, almost dictatorial drive, to form her family and for all of them to do the things that she intends for them to do. Much of them from a place of love. Like, she's not doing it because she's angry at Emily or she hates Emily. She's doing it because she's like, Emily has this talent and I am going to make certain that she uses it and uses it properly in the way that I think that she should. So I think that she's a little different from Jane Eyre at that level, who is much meeker. And then finally begins to gain power and independence as the novel goes on. The stuff like the telegraphing, oh, I call it Wuthering Heights. The whole thing about, seeing the shadowy man riding a horse on the moors. The use of, and I know that this is somewhat historically based, but the Charlotte's infatuation with Heger when they go to Brussels. And the fact that that is supposed to get translated then into the professor. It's too much of telegraphing. It's too much of they just took their lives and they put them down on paper. Though, again, the fact that this film proposes that they're using their brother as the model for their heroes is very weird and interesting in its own way.
And we have to segue into talking about these women because at the end of the day, I'm sure Devotion was marketed as melodrama for ladies. You get these two titans of acting at the time, Olivia de Havilland, Ida Lupino, both notoriously difficult women in Hollywood who did not put up with any fuss. Ida Lupino is billed first. She was the bigger star, which led to her getting a lot of pushback, particularly from her male co-stars. So, like, when she did Out of the Fog, she's billed first. They wanted Humphrey Bogart. She hated working with him during High Sierra and said that she would not do it. And so they cast John Garfield, and it caused Humphrey Bogart to say, well, when was Ida Lupino running the studio? And I love that story because I was like, yes, Ida. And Ida did not like the roles that she got, which is why she turned to directing. She ended up getting suspended so often that she would go and watch the men direct and ask questions and eventually learned how to be a director. And I can see why she would want to be Emily Bronte. I mean, up until this point, she had been dabbling back into doing British stuff and was doing this nice back and forth of doing noirs with women's films. A one for you, one for me type of deal. And so I can see why Emily Bronte as the creator of Wuthering Heights would be appealing, not unlike Elsa Lanchester playing Mary Shelley. And I can see why Olivia would want to play Charlotte Bronte. Olivia de Havilland also was having issues. She actually sued the studio, Warners at the time, because she didn't like the role she was getting. The conspiracy theory, this movie was held for 3 years because they were litigating with her. They say that's not true because a lot of movies that were filmed in 43 were held until 45, 46 because costume dramas and romances weren't really what the country needed. I don't really necessarily subscribe to that. So you have two actresses known for being temperamental playing in this film. I want a movie about the making of this movie. They wanted Emily to be played by Joan Fontaine, who was Olivia de Havilland's sister. The two did not get along at all.
That would have been awesome, though.
And I was going to say, I could see where they planned on Joan Fontaine being in this movie, because Charlotte and Emily have this back and forth relationship. They're constantly bickering. I don't really see them as being friends until Emily is dying. And then Charlotte's like, okay, I'm gonna take care of you. And then at the end, she's like smiling on the heath. I was like, you know, that woman's like, thank God that chick is dead. I can see where Joan Fontaine would work.
I find it actually kind of interesting. I like both of them as actresses. Both of them have very strong personalities. Charlotte struck me as a slight departure for de Havilland. Like I say, I found her very dictatorial, and maybe that's just my impression of the character. But she didn't often get those kinds of roles. She was often much sweeter, much more like a little powerful, but not quite so domineering or attempting to be domineering. So I kind of like that sort of back and forth between the two of them and the fact that they're both very strong personalities. The film gives the impression that they love each other, even though they have completely different ideas about the way that they're supposed to love each other, the way that they're supposed to relate to each other or other members of their family. And then there's this weird, again, love triangle that gets going between them and Paul Heinrich. It's such an odd pairing in a way. Like, when I first saw the cast list, I was like, Ida Lupino and Olivia de Havilland. Okay, in a costume drama. And part of that is because I always associate Ida Lupino with much more hard-boiled roles. And seeing her in, you know, flouncy dresses that are not particularly period-specific was somewhat surprising, whereas Olivia de Havilland is constantly in period dresses. That's half of what she did. I'm always surprised when I see her in regular clothing.
I can definitely see how, on paper, this movie reads as very exciting. Because you have these two women who are just titans of acting. And I think that the problem for the screenwriters, the script for this film is credited to Keith Winter, who is a director of significance. He wrote the screenplay for The Red Shoes. He did additional dialogue for that. He's credited as the writer. It's almost like they're having trouble balancing these roles to give these women equal screen time. And that's a shame, because they're both really good in this movie, but they've done far better work in other things. Bosley Crowther, when he reviewed this movie, and this movie did not get the greatest reviews. James Mason had planned to do a story about Branwell Bronte called The Upturned Glass, and he did not get to it in time. And so when this movie came out, he called it shockingly bad. I think Mason might have been a little overzealous for personal bias. But Bosley Crowther, when he reviewed this, brought up a good point. The Brontes filtered through Louisa May Alcott, that it's got a Little Women mentality to it. And that's exactly what I felt when I watched this. Now, it had been several years since the first iteration of Little Women had come out, I think in 1933. I think is when the first one with Katherine Hepburn.
That sounds right, yeah.
They would do Little Women 3 years later with June Allison. And so you're in between these takes on Little Women, but you have this movie about sisters. Right around the time they were filming this, they had Meet Me in St. Louis. So sisters are a big deal. You want to tell this story about the Brontes, but the Brontes aren't the Marches. So what do? You just fudge it. I definitely felt like I was watching the Brontes as written by the screenwriter of Little Women. Did you notice that?
I feel like it would have actually worked better if they had given more to Anne Bronte, because then you would have had these three sisters, all of whom have completely different approaches to life, completely different approaches to their talents and to their literary output. The story of the Brontes is fascinating in itself because they initially had to publish their work as men, part of which gave rise to the whole conspiracy theory that Branwell Bronte actually wrote all of the books that his sisters published. And so you've got this great story, actually, that if you actually look at the history of the Brontes is very fascinating, but doesn't really get followed through on in the film, partially because they want to add in this romance, they want to deal with Branwell, and for whatever reason, they just want to push Anne off to the side and be like, well, she doesn't really count. In some ways, I think that if they had gone more full Little Women, it would have worked better.
I can see that. I wish they had just embraced a tone, is the issue here. I also didn't really appreciate that they're not happy unless they're in love. That mentality that the Brontes wrote these novels because they couldn't keep a man and they were so frustrated. But this was shelved for 3 years. By the time this came out, it's hard for it not to feel passé, because by that time, there'd already been an adaptation of Jane Eyre, starring Joan Fontaine, the Orson Welles version.
The lives of these people keep on overlapping, because then Joan Fontaine shows up in The Bigamist with Ida Lupino, and Joan Fontaine also married Ida Lupino's ex-husband.
Yeah.
The whole thing is just, it's bizarre.
I think this whole movie is a conspiracy theory by Joan Fontaine. I'm just saying.
There you go. I would not have put it past her, given the way that she and de Havilland hated each other.
Exactly. So you had a lot of costume dramas that were doing material that this movie was already covering. So you had Wuthering Heights in 1939, the Merle Oberon, Laurence Olivier version, which is probably one of my favorite adaptations.
Yeah, I love that.
Then you had Jane Eyre in 43, the year they were filming this. Which means that this movie, they already knew, was going to be hot on the heels. I actually would have loved to have known what would have happened if they had released this in 43 when it had been made, and what that would have done. In 1940, you had Rebecca, which was not Bronte, but still another costume drama that was in this vein. And then the same year this came out, you had Dragonwick, which is a movie that I think is pretty much this movie if it had decided to go dark. Is it hard for you to watch this knowing that there were just so many other movies that had done this better?
Yes and no, because I think this is one of the few films that is actually about the Brontes that isn't an adaptation of the Brontes. Rebecca is just a modernized version of Jane Eyre. As brilliant as it is, I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but that's what the book is, that's what the film is. I was intrigued by this when you suggested it, because I was like, actually dealing with the Brontes, the actual human beings, and I did not expect historical accuracy necessarily. It would have been interesting to see how they represented it. The fact that they failed on so many levels does kind of make you go like, well, why not just do like a fictionalized version about three sisters and a brother, all of whom are writers? Like, we can just do that and we can have all sorts of exciting things happening. It doesn't have to be about the Brontes specifically.
Before we close things out, what are some Ida Lupino acting performances that you recommend over this?
So many. Choose one. She is brilliant in The Bigamist, which I saw not that long ago and was just blown away by her. First of all, she's directing it, but second of all, she's acting in it, and she's brilliant in that. One of my other favorite films of hers is Beware My Lovely, which is a sort of odd chamber drama that's her and Robert Ryan, in which she is a widow who hires a handyman to do some work around the house, and basically begins to come out that he's obsessed with her and that he's a schizophrenic, and he essentially imprisons her in this house, and he begins having all of these fantasies about what he means to her and what she means to him and all that. There's a section of the film that I really dislike because her character is so powerful, and then it kind of leads up to this point, and it's ridiculous, but her performance is brilliant, and her back and forth between her and Robert Ryan is amazing. I really like her in High Sierra. I find it interesting that they disliked each other so much because her and Humphrey Bogart are so good together.
They're very cute together, and they have a dog.
Yeah.
Which is Humphrey Bogart's dog, by the way.
And the other one that she has a much smaller role in, but she's very good in it, is the 1955 film noir, The Big Knife, which is her and Jack Palance and Gene Hagen and Shelley Winters. She plays Jack Palance's ex-wife. And it's, again, a very small part, but very powerful. The film across the board is brilliant and quite surprising because I'm not a big Jack Palance fan to begin with. But she is great in it, and it takes some very interesting twists and turns that I did not expect, but that is some of them quite shocking for the time period.
Well, as for me, since I'm still going through her filmography, I can't recommend a lot of her 30s films because she's not really in them significantly. 1939's The Lone Wolf Spy Hunt, which is entry in the long-running Lone Wolf mystery series with Warren William. She's really good as the nagging girlfriend slash trying to be Myrna Loy in The Thin Man. She's really fun in that. We both agree they drive by night. Her first big villainess role, she is so good in that movie. Although, I don't necessarily think she should be getting all uppity over George Raft, because it's George Raft. I also would say, Ladies in Retirement, she plays a English maid who is trying to keep her mentally deranged sisters with her in the house, and eventually has to turn to murder in order to achieve that. Ooh. It's really fun. The aforementioned High Sierra, and I cannot stress enough my love of Out of the Fog. Out of the Fog is a 1941 film noir with the most bizarre plotline, because it involves Thomas Mitchell and John Quaylen play Russian immigrants that just like to fish. That's it. That's their American dream. They work and they fish. John Garfield shows up in a really sweet coat. Sweet series of coats. Tells them that they're going to pay him to protect their boat. They are essentially being extorted by him. And meanwhile, he takes a shine to Thomas Mitchell's daughter, who is Ida Lupino, who wants excitement. She doesn't want to settle down with boring, stuffy Eddie Albert. She wants to go to Cuba with John Garfield. And I'm just sitting there thinking, yeah, let her go. He's hot. I'm not seeing a problem. Suffice it to say, it's a film noir, so you should know how things happen at the end. But it's really good. Overall thoughts about Devotion. What did you think about this overall?
No, it's impossible to recommend this film. I think it's an interesting oddity if you like Ida Lupino or Olivia de Havilland. It's interesting where it goes so wrong, and there can be a degree of pleasure in that. At the end of the day, my biggest problem is that I was bored by it a lot of the time. Like I said, I had to turn it off a couple of times just to go and do other things. Not because it was necessarily bad, but just because I was bored. And that's not a good sign in a film. If you just are kind of like meh, then I would much rather hate a film than be meh about it.
I thought this was going to be better. Maybe I should have done my due diligence before we talked about it. Although the fact that we were able to still do a full-length episode about a movie that we didn't necessarily like, I think says a lot. It's an interesting oddity, I think, in both Ida Lupino's filmography and Olivia de Havilland's filmography. If you ever wanted to see the two of them in a movie together, this is it. This is for you. I think that it's very confused about what it wants to do. It's very confused about what it wants to be. It's obvious that they knew that they were already going to look passé compared to the adaptations of the Bronte works that were already out. It's a nice-looking failure, I think is the best way to describe it. Of course, you can let me know your thoughts on Devotion. You can tell me and Lauren that we're completely wrong about this movie. Or you can tell me your favorite Ida Lupino acting roles. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and I'll read them on the next episode. Lauren will be back next episode, so we're not going to thank her just yet. But in case you want to talk to her more before we record again, where can fans find and get in touch with you online, Lauren?
They can find me on Twitter at LHBusiness, and my email address is also on my website, which is suddenlyashotrangout.com.
That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a variety of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, or even if you aren't, if you just have iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out by leaving a rating and review. The rating actually is more important than the review, but I will take either. And if you haven't left one yet, you might want to consider it, because starting in March, I will be giving away some swag for those who help out the podcast by leaving us a rating on iTunes. So consider it. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, @gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter, so you can send me questions, comments, gifts to @ticklish_biz. Want to learn about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks. There's going to be some great exclusive content that you'll only be able to hear if you are a Patreon member. That's not to say that I'm not going to show it at some point, but you will get to hear it before everybody else. So all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the classic film podcast that it is and that it could be. So if you're interested in learning more, you can just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year? If you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club, TCM Backlot, you can actually read my year-long series about the stars that I'm spotlighting on Ticklish Business this year, discussing their films and information that you won't hear on the show. So I have a great article about Ida Lupino that is going to be up on TCM Backlot in the next couple of days. So if you want to learn more about Ida and all the crazy films she did, you should definitely head over and read that if you're a member. Next time, though, Lauren is going to join me to close out the month with a look at Ida Lupino as a director, the 1950 film Outrage. Until next time.